Hello, I'm Simon Burton and welcome to Arts Roundup, where we'll look at clean technology developed in Cambridge showcased through art on the city streets. Find out how an artist's painted squares develop a personality of their own, get the latest on phone apps for sculpture walks, and meet artists from Norwich generating an air of thought-provoking experimentation during a Cambridge residency. In this edition, we review the recent Illuminate Festival of Light, which begins a new era in using public spaces and buildings in Cambridge at night to educate us about cutting-edge clean technology with artwork. Artist Adrian Parnell talks about his inspired work at a new exhibition at the Lindstrover Gallery in Fendittin. We look at enhanced sculpture walks using new smartphone apps that let you know what's out there to enjoy. Artists from Norwich's Outposts Art Space open a new temporary residency at Kettle's Yard and join a panel to talk on arts in the East this evening. And we look at upcoming events in the arts sector that give homeless people a chance to turn the tables on life in the city streets and be creative with FLAC's Diane Morrison. The benefits of breakthroughs in new state-of-the-art clean light and glass technology being developed in Cambridge are often a little difficult to fathom for the uninitiated, and there's been a problem in explaining it fully and how it's rapidly changing the world environmentally by saving and generating energy. Light technology's ability to lend itself to doing interesting things with light in public spaces at night gave rise to a new idea. February saw the beginning of the new Illuminate Festival of Light in Cambridge, which looks set to become annual, heralding a whole new facet of life on the city's darkened streets as green technology is used to light up engaging artworks which demonstrate what the technology does. It's a collaboration bringing together the Cambridge Film Trust, Cambridge University, Enlight, Barclays Electrical and Solar, among other firms, and local visual artists at Cambridge School of Art. Illuminate Festival of Light was the brainchild of director Alexandra Cajano, who wants the city to adopt a new attitude towards enjoying visual assets of the city in a way unique to the Cambridge story. Alexandra, how did this amazing project start off in the first place?
I had an idea. I come from a city in Italy called Turin, and we have a wonderful light festival which runs from October to February, I think. It's a very long event, very well established, and it's a great inspiration. When I moved to Cambridge, I always had a dream to do something like this, and Cambridge is perfect for this. It's got so much beauty all around it. Beautiful buildings, architecture, and very dark streets, which make it just the perfect place for it. But I wanted to be different from all of the other lights festivals which are run throughout Europe. And there came the idea of using clean technology, which is very strong in the Cambridge cluster. And I know this because of my other job.
Now, this project combines the two things, doesn't it? The art scene and new technology in the form of light. Tremendously exciting. Where did the different partners in the project come from?
This year we have basically use word of mouth in the very first instance. So we reached out to all of the people we worked with previously. So most of the exhibitors actually I have worked with in my capacity of event manager. Some of the artists have been, most of the artists are actually local. Some of them are from the university, which we thought was really important to bring the students into the mix. And some others actually come from further afield because we thought we just want to make the most of this event. So we didn't want to discriminate geographically.
You've got quite a large number of stakeholders. You've got several technology companies, you've got several artists, you've got Cambridge City Council and Cambridge University,
yes,
all involved in the same project, which you have brought together under your own steam. I hear that you had something like 100 meetings to realise this project. Where did all that energy come from? You just felt it was something that had to be done in Cambridge.
Yes, definitely. I really believed in the idea, and I have found so many people who really helped me because they believed in the idea too. And I think that's the real value of collaboration. It's why this city is wonderful.
This evening the lights have gone on in various locations around Cambridge. What are people going to see? Because there's lots of key landmark buildings are suddenly different. Where are these points of reference and what will they see there?
So this year, as I said, we're starting small. We want to build on for the future years. Everything that was done this year was almost with no funding whatsoever. So what we will see this year is an installation in the Senate House Lawn, one in Great St. Mary's, two in Sussex Street, and one in Grand Arcade, and one in John Lewis. So a variety of places. We kept it very focused to the city centre, but as we said, we really hope to build on for the next year.
Now these are light shows, they're projections.
There is a mixture.
What are the surprises?
Oh, well, it's a surprise. You're going to have to go and see it yourself.
Now, there's also a solar car as part of this exhibition,
indeed,
which I gather is in the middle of the Grafton Centre now for people to look at. Now,
it is in the Grand Arcade,
That was a tremendous project, wasn't it? Who was involved in that?
So we thought it was a fantastic idea to bring them on board, because that really embodies the theme of the festival. So it's an amazing work of art in the sense of design, but also with amazing clean technology. So the car is completely covered with solar panels, and it runs on solar energy, and it's used for the Eco Solar Challenge, which runs in Australia every 2 years. And it's completely built by the Cambridge University Eco Racing Car students, which are based at the engineering department of the Cambridge University. So that's pretty amazing itself.
Now most of the companies involved that have provided the technology, this is very green technology, isn't it? How does it save money?
So the idea is to show people how they can save money, show it in a way that particularly spectacular. And sometimes we feel that the technology is a bit overwhelming and it's really hard to get your head around it. We're using technology and art, the function of art is really to work as a translator, to explain the technology in a way, to show us how it works in practice so that more and more people can actually adopt.
Great stuff. The woman who's changed the face of Cambridge forever with all these light shows, thank you very much indeed for spending time to talk to us.
Thank you.
The launch featured lighting up one side of Great St Mary's Church, the Pitt Building, and a light-sensitive greenhouse structure on the Senate House lawn. The Illuminate team demonstrated a smartphone app for an interactive window in Robert Sales in Downing Street, and a competition solar car built by university students drew passers-by in the Grand Arcade. Local artist Lucas Morley created a moving visual in a large shop window in Sussex Street. It all showed how entertaining some high-tech smoke and mirrors can be using an artist to get the message across. Business Development Director of Cambridge Light technology firm Barclays Electrical and Solar, Mike Kay, gave a brief talk on the colourful high-tech greenhouse structure on the Senate House lawn. What looks like ordinary glass is in fact polysolar industrial glass panels which create energy. Fantastic project, obviously lots of stakeholders in it this evening. Can you tell me a little bit about this greenhouse which is lit up on the Senate House lawn? Because you were saying that it has lots of features in it which at first glance you wouldn't actually properly understand how that works.
Yeah, well, the really exciting thing about the greenhouse on the lawn is it's a sort of expression of polysolar's industrial glass, and the great advantage with the glass is that it can create energy. So you've got the ability within the greenhouse structure, it's a sort of physical representation of the power that can be created on buildings by using photovoltaic glass.
Obviously the different coloured glass filters light for different purposes. That's useful. Why exactly? Why is that clever?
One of the clever things about the glasses is if you think about a lot of commercial greenhouse installations, they need a certain amount of light and the correct type of light to get the best optimum growth out of the plants. What the polysolar panels do is they achieve that because they let the right amount of light through into the greenhouses to create the perfect growing environment. When you harness that with LED lights as well, you can create a natural environment for the plants to grow to get optimum production out of them.
It doesn't look like clever glass, but it is, isn't it?
Oh, it's very, very clever glass. I mean, realistically, what more companies should be doing now, especially architectural companies, when they specify a glass building, they should be looking at ways of making that building into effectively a solar farm rather than just a very large glass facade.
Why did you decide to become part of Illuminate as a company?
Our whole ethos as a company is about creating energy neutral buildings, so a building that can effectively create its own power and light from the natural resources that within the structure of the building and also with the energy consumption that the building uses. So we look to reduce energy within a building and then create the power it needs.
Now, mixing that with art is quite a new idea, isn't it? I mean, art to show off these things to people.
Well, I think it's really exciting, and I think it might sound like a new idea, but I mean, in Cambridge you've got thousands of really fantastic buildings. They're an expression of art in the real sense of the word. This is just another evolution of that, and we're just using technology to expand that horizon.
Fantastic, great project. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We investigated a solar car built by Cambridge University's Eco Racing team. Second-year engineering student at Girton College, Kenno Mariogi, talks about his team, who are also about to build a second new prototype for entry into the World Eco Solar Challenge competition. The prototype car, designed and built entirely by students, is flat, covered in solar panels, very light, and has a space-age appearance with a tiny cockpit. It can top 140 kilometres per hour in the midday sun. Here's Kenno Mariogi on the project.
What we've done is we learned a lot from this car, learned how solar cars work and how we can basically go faster. And we've come up with this new concept there. Now, all across the world, everyone's making solar cars like this. But this is what solar cars used to look like. This is what solar cars are going to look like now. And instead of going for the make a huge wide car, collect as much energy as you can, and then try and make your car look a bit smooth and aerodynamic, what we've done is we've gone, let's make a really aerodynamic car, and then try and get the best solar performance we can out of the car. So you see there's a couple of plates there, and what they do is they're covered in solar cells. And these plates basically track the sun's profile during the day. And so by having the sun perpendicular for most of the day, we can get about 15 to 20% more power. And we're quite excited for the World Solar Challenge this year because no one's ever done anything like this. And we think we might finally be able to beat the Japanese, the Americans, the Dutch, and just beat them with clever design as opposed to more money. The Dutch, about 10 years ago, thought, we can make a car go really fast by making it three wheels and looking like this. No one took them seriously, and then they won. And then no one took them seriously, and then they won again. So people started taking it quite seriously, and so now almost every car looks like this. Then the Japanese took their idea and pumped even more money into it. They were sponsored by Panasonic, all these other like really top, you know, the Japanese top dog. And basically, Japanese put more money into it and did it better. And then they won for the last 2 years. And so this year, the organizers banned three-wheeled cars and it's only four-wheeled vehicles now. And they've put a greater emphasis on safety. So if you look at this car right now, it's quite cramped and it's quite small. And let's say, heaven forbid, but we had an accident, would do myself a bit of damage on the fact that it's not very big. But now you have to be able to swing through like this space without crashing into anything. And so the cars have had to get bigger. There's also like stricter rules on visibility. So you have to be able to see a spot on the ground 4 meters ahead, and the car is 4.5 meters long, so you have to basically sit at the front. And so it's a lot more safety conscious now on the design. So hopefully the technologies we develop will actually be able to be more applicable to real cars. I mean, lightweight manufacture and really efficient motors. Top speed on that is 140 at midday, because you only ever get peak power at midday. But all our modeling and CFD and aerodynamics says that we can hit 140 at midday, and we're going to average about 82 kilometers an hour.
A refreshing new and visually exciting contemporary art exhibition has opened at the Lynn Strover Gallery in Fendenden High Street and runs until March the 30th. Potts, Paintings and Prints combines the work of artist Adrian Parnell, who paints textured grid paintings, a series of Dorset rolling landscape prints by Liz Somerville, and a series of ceramic pots by Sam Hall. Lynn Strover introduces the new show, featuring some 20 works. Lynn, a fantastically visually attractive exhibition here that's just opening at the Lynn Strover Gallery in the High Street in Fendenden. Can you tell me what led up to this exhibition? What was the idea that sparked it, as it were?
Oh, well, it's quite organic, really. That I think initially Adrian Parnell brought some work to the gallery, and I really liked it. And then I had to work out a combination of work that would hang together. And so then I brought as a contract Liz Somerville prints, and then thought, not quite there yet. Went down to Cornwall, was standing in a small gallery looking at these ceramics, and thought, that's it. After that, I'm really delighted how well they have come together.
How important is it for you to, when you lay out an exhibition like this, for each of the different artists to visually correspond with each other as well as individually?
Yeah. Extremely important. I'm very visual. So I've just had an email back. I asked a new artist for an artist statement, and she said, I come from a generation when we didn't do artist statements. Our work spoke for itself. And I think I come from that same generation.
Now, I met Adrian Parnell a little bit earlier, who talked about his paintings, which have some fantastically interesting features, which we're going to talk a little bit about with Adrian.
Not least of all his titles. Yes.
His pictures are interesting because even within the actual picture, the different parts of the picture correspond with each other. So it kind of, the exhibition kind of has like two levels, doesn't it? Because you've got that kind of art in it, and then you've got the different artists as well. So it makes an interesting path to actually think about that when you're going.
Well, I always try and make it worth coming to look at, whichever show I do, really. You know, it's not all about selling work, it is just something when people walk in, they have a very pleasant experience.
Are there going to be opportunities for people during the course of the exhibition to meet some of the other artists?
Yeah, Liz Somerville's coming on the 23rd of this month to talk to people. She couldn't make it on Saturday, but we're really looking forward to her coming up. She's an interesting lady.
Do you want to talk a little bit about some of the key works that are in the exhibition? What's your favourite one?
I get a kick out of how it all hangs together, and I take great pride in that. So.
There's some 20, 30 pieces of work in this exhibition, is that right?
20, yes. 20, yes.
Yeah. When does the exhibition run until?
It runs until the 30th of March.
And people can come at any time during the day?
10 till 4, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday and Saturday. And it'll all be on our new website. I'm a commercial gallery by necessity, but it's not really... I do want people to have a nice experience and think it's something worth coming to see. And if they buy, then that's a bonus for everybody.
And a lot of people did come for the opening private view.
Indeed. Yeah. Doors are open to the public from yesterday, actually. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Till the 23rd of March.
Lynn Strober, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, my pleasure. Nice to see you again.
Artist Adrian Parnell uses geometric textured art with aesthetics based on his appreciation of Cornish granite, which he grew up with all around him. He paints with aligned squares, which have much more depth to them than you might suppose. He explains the squares are really living things in his work. Can you tell me, first of all, how you came to connect with Lynn Strober's gallery and this exhibition?
I had some work a couple of years ago at the Royal College of Art, Kensington, an exhibition there. Well, she was also exhibiting there. And I thought, oh, she's an interesting person, and sent her some photographs of my work. And she phoned me back and said, you know, I'd like to give you a show. So that was a couple of years ago. So I've worked towards this exhibition that started today.
What kind of techniques are you using to produce these wonderful paintings, which have a lot of rectangular squares, wonderful aesthetics and colours? Yeah. How do you produce them?
I went to St Martin's and the Slade for 7 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, the old sort of Sicurtian type way of squaring up your drawing into to become a painting.
Yeah.
You know, so you've got all this prepared canvas with all these squares. One day I thought, well, instead of squaring them up for a painting of a landscape or something, or a figure or whatever, I thought I'd just mess around with the squares. And that was, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. And that's how this particular stuff started. So then it was a question of which colour works against another, which was difficult because you're making up colours. You're not relying upon local colour of the landscape you're painting or the weather effect or whatever. You're relying purely on what you fancy or what you think works best against another colour. So that took quite a long time to sort of get into the mode of using one's just visual, well, just learning a repertoire of colours that you could work with, you know, because I started off with blues. It was too cold and it was too easy. So I had to find colours that sort of... Then I went to the opposite extreme of colours that clashed with each other, like viridian and purple, you know, orange and red or... And that was too difficult. It was too easy in one sense, because everybody's done that since St Ives, you know, in the 60s, 50s, 60s. So then you just eventually use the landscape colours as a starting point where you were originally and then work from there. And they can become quite brown and ochre-y and dull. So then you've got to have some key points to... like the bright greens or something, to offset that, you know, like you would in an ordinary painting. You've got a focal point, a point of interest, whether it's somebody murdering somebody or, you know, some colours obviously come forward, some go back. Some are put on thicker and some are put on thinner. So they sort of became...
They have identities. Or
yeah, they became identities of a crowd of people, you know. Some are... flashy, bright yellow, pointed shoes and lovely legs, and then there's the man in the tweed cap, you know. That's how I identified the squares and the colours.
So you've got this wonderful colour architecture, you've got a personality to each one of these squares, but then you also have the element of the textures that you've used.
Yeah.
Because those are created, how exactly?
Well, a lot of those paintings have been literally painted over and over and over again. And because as soon as you put one square down and you put another colour next to it and then a third one above or below that, it does. Yeah, so yeah. Then you've got to work out until you've got something that blends together. So a lot of it's been reworked time and time and time again, which gives it a very textured look. But then on top of that, I've been using some really naff old brushes. You know those things you clean windows with, you know, that silkscreen squeegee things, anything that will give you a sort of wipe across the picture rather than a brush mark.
And there are sort of dappled effects. Are you using some kind of paste or plaster to create those?
No, it's purely having built up so many layers, and then you wipe across with a piece of card or something, another paint, it picks up the knobs of the history underneath. It's a bit like the opposite of what Ben Nicholson was doing, which was scraping it away. So you left rough, you know, you took away the rough edges. I'm building up on the rough edges.
Now you've given, I mean, obviously these squares have wonderful textures. They're visually exciting. They have a personality. What came to, in the naming of it, you've got one called 40 Criminals. You chose lots of names like that, which kind of give it a kind of misty.
Because that one's a bit dark. That painting's got a lot of dark areas in it. And there were 40 squares in that painting, so each one became sort of identities. This became a sort of criminal gang, whereas some of them are much lighter, and it depends on the time of year, you know, like I've finished one on Valentine's Day, so that's called Love Letters now.
It's wonderful. The paintings were the dynamic and personalities within the actual work, which is entirely abstract as well, which is just
I think that's because of my history of, you know, 45 years of painting figures and landscapes. I couldn't instantly switch from realism to abstract. It's sort of bits of it have come with me and bits of it have been left behind.
Now, how important is it for you to have an exhibition like this at Lynn Strober Galleries? And obviously you've got a great exhibition here, but you've also come here to watch people's reactions to what you've done.
Well, it seems to me they're more fascinated by the names that I've put on these paintings. Which helps, because it sort of makes them look at the painting through my eyes a bit more, maybe, rather than just calling it number one or October 1960 or something, you know, or whatever. It's
a wonderful intuitive clues in the names of the paintings. Is there anything else you wanted to say? Adrian Parnell, thank you very much indeed for talking to Cambridge 105.
Cambridge has an unusually high number of remarkable large-scale sculptures out in the open, and there's much to discover across the city, if only you knew where exactly to look. If it's just to fill a few unforgiving minutes, or spend a couple of hours appreciating modern masterpieces by Henry Moore, or perhaps Peter Randall Page. I've been talking to Cambridge Sculpture Trails, who after running art walks for several years, have just launched a new smartphone app so that people can find out about astonishing works close by, wherever they happen to be in the city. Cambridge Sculpture Trails, Mary Munro and Heather Warwick introduced the app.
There are a range of stunning sculptures, aren't they, from people like Henry Moore, from other sculptors like Barbara Hepworth. Can you tell me a bit about the range of what people can actually discover in Cambridge if they were to look in the right coordinates, as it were? That's what this app's all about.
Well, the app covers very much the same range of sculpture as the leaflets and the website. And there are sculptures by very well-known international sculptors. And there are also sculptures by some local people, some people whose names are perhaps not so familiar to the general public. But on the whole, they're pretty high quality. Would you agree?
Yes, they are. And they range in size, say from the Barbara Hepworth four square walk through at Churchill, which is very large, down to quite small ones such as Bernard Meadows bronze, also in Churchill actually, which is small and on a plinth and fairly exquisite in its way.
And some of these sculptures, obviously they're visually very attractive, very different, very interesting, but you can also touch some of them, you can sit on them, you can climb through them. You can have quite an experience encountering interesting and large-scale sculptures, can't you? And they make a lot of difference to the open spaces in Cambridge.
Yes, there's a piece outside the Carlucci's cafe, which is by Peter Randall Page, which is, you've probably seen it, that great big lump of granite. And it's very tactile, and children love playing with it. They love touching it, and you know, so that's a real positive thing about having sculpture in the open air. And also there's some Peter Randall Pages outside the Fitzwilliam Museum, but they are behind bars at night, so I don't think people get in to feel them quite the same way. But no, there's nothing to stop people, I suppose. But it is an issue about public sculpture. They have to be fairly robust. You know, you've seen the one in the Market Square, haven't you? The one of Snowy. Well, you know, that's already been vandalised slightly, and it's been made in a very robust way.
It was quite astonishing, actually, wasn't it, that they didn't actually put a collection box as part of that sculpture, because that was what Snowy's life was all about.
You'd like to have seen that.
They created a wonderful sculpture that characterised Snowy, someone who I knew since I was a tiny child, and then they didn't have the money collecting side of it included in the sculpture, which was a comment that many people made.
Exactly, and he gave a lot of money, didn't he? So you like it. Does it remind you of Snowy?
It does remind me of Snowy. I mean, I'm sure that other things could have been done that would have also done that, but I did think it did, you know, create that Snowy far feeling. My little sister obviously always used to love playing with his mice on a Saturday morning in the middle of Cambridge.
It gets a lot of criticism. Lots of people think it's awful and a terrible waste of public money, but you know.
Now, how many different sculpture trails are there included within the scheme?
Three at the moment, although as Cambridge is getting more and more sculptures gradually, we might have to divide at least one of them up, yes. But they've been divided into three walks, each of which takes about, say, 2 hours, an hour and a half.
Is that sort of contrasting logic between the different walks, or is it more of a kind of geographical thing that makes them convenient?
Purely geographical.
Now, I mean, obviously using smartphone apps for looking at art in public spaces is becoming increasingly popular as a trend. What do you think it is about doing that makes it interesting? I mean, I was sort of thinking that it's about using every scrap of time that you have in an interesting and engaging way, and if you can do that with a smartphone, you know, instead of just walking down the street in a bit of a dream, sort of thinking about things, you can actually say, well, actually, for the next 10 minutes I'm going to do a little excursion into the art dimension with an app.
And the app tells you how far you are from the nearest sculpture. And also, if you want to, it tells you the website of the sculpture. So if you want to know more about that particular artist, you just click on the app and you get the website.
You get the full story.
Absolutely.
And are there any interesting stories that you can tell us about a particular artist that people might find surprising or amazing or not know about?
We've just been, you mentioned that children or people like to touch or walk through sculpture. We've actually been standing on one this afternoon. I wouldn't normally recommend that. But have you seen the Anthony Gormley on the Downing site outside the
I'm not familiar with
Museum
it, actually.
Museum of Archaeology? So he has cast his body, or had it cast for him, and it's been installed vertically. He's a tall man, so it goes down into the ground a long way, and all that is exposed are his feet. There isn't even a plinth or anything around it, so some people may inadvertently have been walking over it and not realizing it. Or you can stand on his feet and have a wish, maybe.
It's very strange.
And wandering around Cambridge these days, you can run into the most striking art in terms of sculptures. I mean, even going into Parkside Pools, there's a beautiful sculpture of a swimmer in bronze. This is all about getting into all the different corners, isn't it? And discovering the things that you didn't know were there, which is absolutely great. What does sculpture do for you personally? I mean, what's your personal interest in it? Why have you gotten involved in doing this?
Well, I did an art degree as a mature student, which we could do modules of at Anglia Ruskin. And I found sculpture was the module that excited me the most, because it got me thinking in a 3D way and my drawing improved. I could see the world in a much different way as to how we are related to the space around us and how objects are related to space.
In the top 10, which ones would you say they were in Cambridge, the ones that you absolutely must see if you're out and about?
I find it very difficult because I think the important things about the sculpture trails is that it gives people a chance to look at all sorts of different things and different people like different things, you know. We've just been in Emmanuel College looking at a very nice piece called Jester, which you may well know, which I think is, I have to say, is one of my favourites in Cambridge. But there are lots of other ones in different ways.
And there's also the, I mean, you may be able to find those ones in public places, of which there are, what, some, how many, 50 or 60 of them?
We have about at least that.
But then there are all the ones that go into the Art in the Garden events as well, aren't there?
Yes.
Which probably makes the number of things that are worth going to see much, much larger than that even in one summer.
Yes, it is. I think one of the reasons we're getting more and more in Cambridge is also because of this requirement for people putting up a new building to spend 1% of construction money on public art. And this has brought about quite a lot of new pieces in Cambridge. And that's what's very exciting, because we happen to live in a kind of, you know, commercial bubble here in Cambridge where there are new buildings going up still. And we hope to see new sculpture with each one of them.
Is there a danger that these sculptures could actually be stolen? Some of them very, very valuable. Like the one in London the other day that was removed from a brick wall and taken off somewhere. Because they must be very valuable, some of them.
Yes, we were very relieved that was not sold. You were talking about the Banksy.
The Banksy, that's right. Yeah.
But there was also a very, very nice Barbara Hepworth, which was stolen from Dulwich. And by people who wanted the bronze to melt it down. Yes, I mean, I think there is a danger of that, and it slightly worries us sometimes we're telling people where they are. But, you know, I think it's people who are looking for the metal, which is it's a very worrying trend, but let's hope it doesn't come to Cambridge.
So this app that you can download, where can you download it from?
From Apple iTunes and Google, what is it called, Play or
Google Shop anyway, whatever.
And it's called Cambridge Sculpture Trails, is it the link?
Yes, and it's free.
So that has presumably a geographical map and then points upon it that you click on
to get the
bit that you want. Are there any other features in the storytelling, as it were, or the tracks that come through on that? Any other features?
It tells you a little bit about each sculpture, and it tells you how far away you are from them, and it gives you these hot links to the sculptor's website. And for some of the college ones, it also gives you the telephone number of the college Poulter's Lodge, because you can't always get into colleges if they happen to be closed for the quiet period or for one reason or another. So if people really want to check up that they're going to be able to get into, for example, Jesus College, which is a big collection of sculpture, it's not a bad idea to ring the Poulter's first.
Cambridge Sculpture Trails, you can download it from the internet. Fantastic. Thank you both very much indeed for coming in.
Thank you.
At Kettle's Yard this evening, there's a chance to attend a symposium discussion on the role of artists in the Eastern region. The panel comprises members of the Norwich-based Outpost Art Space Steering Committee, Amy Botfield of the Arts Council of England, Kettle's Yard director Andrew Nern, and artist Lucy Polak. It's just one event in the current residency entitled Congratulations, You're the Most Recent Visitor, currently running through until April. Artists from Outposts, a leading art space supporting emerging artists in Norwich, are providing a collaborative snapshot of their creative talents, which involves experimenting with the exhibition content over a month covering a variety of media. It encompasses a broad spectrum of work by artists including Jack Brindley, Lucy Kunoshi, Ian Giles, Joel Holmberg, James Iverson, Rob Lai, Joanne Masding, Lucy Polak, Tessa Payne and Robin Webb, who are running a lively programme of performances, exhibits and events. Outpost steering committees James Epps, Matthew Ferguson and Amy Bergen introduced the show at the launch night. The Outpost Steering Committee, what is it and what's the concept behind it?
And the Outpost Steering Committee comprises 8 people. We work on a voluntary basis to programme exhibitions and events in the gallery in Norwich.
That's an art space in Norwich.
Yeah, which was set up in 2004 by a committee then, and there's a kind of rolling committee which served for a maximum of 2 years. So we have this limited time span.
What characterises Outpost? What makes it different from other organisations? What's its kind of mission
well,
in life?
We've got yellow paper.
Yellow paper.
I guess that we're keen on supporting emerging artists. We try to give solo exhibitions to artists who haven't previously had the kind of exposure that mid-career artists would have. So we try to give them a platform to develop their practices. So they're rather young emerging artists.
Yes, so we don't have those concerns of audience numbers or to meet any specific requirements. So we can take risks with who we program and give them freedom to do whatever they want to do, which I suppose lots of other spaces can't offer.
More and more spaces are doing this exchange, sending things to other cities and inviting people from outside to come in. What does that do, in fact, for your kind of knowledge and management of arts events? Does it sort of provide more and more material for you to think about and plan for future events?
I suppose we have our membership, which is a really good resource. It's about 400 members who submit work to this archive we have. And that, in particular for this show, we have programmed or selected works entirely from that archive. But I suppose the audience is great. It's a great way to show in a new space.
And I think it's particularly beneficial for artists who might show at Outposts and are from Norwich to show in a new city, and they get a completely new audience. And it's a much more high-profile exhibition to show at Kettle's Yard than it might be at Outposts, and it exposes these new emerging artists to a whole new audience.
Can you tell me a little bit about your work in this exhibition? What have you done here and why?
None of the steering committee have any work in the show, but we've jointly, the committee have selected the artists from the membership. So we've worked with everyone else on the committee, and we've worked alongside the artists to achieve something that both the committee and the artists are happy with.
What was the central idea behind what's on show in this temporary residency?
It was about using the membership, but it's not a complete overview of the membership. It's just almost a snapshot. It gives an idea of some of the different artists, some very young artists, some more established artists working a lot of different forms of medium in different geographical locations. And it's, I hope we've given a slight indication of the breadth of what happens at Outpost.
Mm. I suppose it's a reflection of artists who the current committee are interested in. I suppose in a few years the committee will change at the gallery, and then they will be interested in different artists. So this is just a particular reference to this time.
But also I think that it's about representing a different type of work that Kettle's Yard would usually present. I think we're quite conscious of the programme at Kettle's Yard and how it focused on modernism, and we wanted to really represent emerging artists, younger artists who would not normally have the opportunity to show here, which is why we've selected the type of work and artists that we have.
What will people encounter when they come in here? There's quite a few things on display.
The first thing is that they'll be congratulated for being the most recent visitor, which is a piece by Joel Homburg.
It's a performance.
A performance piece, which kind of sets the tone of, which the title is already also taken. Congratulations, you're the most recent visitor. But other works, there's painting works by James Iverson, some work by Lucy Connicky.
There's a lot of screen-based works, there's lots of moving image, different types of moving image, presented in different formats as well. Painting features heavily, but also ceramics as well, so there's much more traditional craft forms, I guess, which are perhaps tying closely to the collection at Kettle's Yard as well.
It looks like it's visually a very interesting show. There's a very interesting screen-based thing which has people doing strange things in the woods. Where did that come from?
That's by an artist called Lucy Pavlak. She's actually on residency in the Fogo Islands in Newfoundland at the moment, and she made that maybe 2 weeks ago in the Fogo Islands, so that's incredibly fresh new work that's kind of premiering here at the in this exhibition. And what's that about? I mean, she's interested in kind of online technology and how you might have web-based interfaces, so it kind of tries to imitate a touchscreen sensation, and so the viewer watching it was invited to kind of respond to the action that's happening on screen and touch and handle various objects that are presented in front of them on the plinth that we've made to watch it from.
There are some ceramics there as well. Where did they come from?
They're Lucy Canici's pieces that she's made over the past few weeks. A lot of them she made at Wising Arts Centre, which is just down the road, and that's a fantastic art centre that supports a lot of artists from the region, and we've had really good connections with. Yeah, and they're different penises, basically, done in very much the kind of style of graffiti or you might get on like a teenager's textbook, and she's almost celebrating that form in quite a simple way. Quite a simple way. It's kind of
it's
the nude
playful, and it's, I think, I mean, it stands to be is quite explicit in content, but also it's presented in an incredibly playful way, and it has this really beautiful production. She's glazed these ceramics, they look really sumptuous, and so I mean it kind of really stands out in the show. But also they're accompanied by lots of ceramic lemons as well, so it's kind of this strange pairing sharing between objects and forms. And she's essentially like a local artist. She was born in Cambridge, so it's quite interesting to have her back here as well.
Great stuff. Thank you all very much indeed.
Thank you so much.
Artist Gemma Melton took time out to talk about her work exhibited outside the gallery's entrance.
Your work is actually, apart from the others, because it's actually outside the entrance to Kettle's Yard, wonderfully extraordinary materials that you've used there. Can you tell me what those are?
Yeah, they are quite a lot from bicycles and waste materials, actually. So I managed to acquire a lot of inner tubes and old bicycle wheels.
And those are not immediately recognisable because obviously you've changed the nature of them by cutting them up and giving them these wonderful colours and proportions, things like that. What is it that you try to do with your work?
It's sort of a transformation, so there's always this kind of link. It's got to be changed. It can't just be an inner tube. I've got to do something which makes it unique. And that's where the destruction process comes in, cutting the work, colouring it, transforming it.
It turns into something else, which creates quite an impact because they're quite large pieces, aren't they? I mean, you've got this series of bicycle tyres and inner tubes, but they're coloured, they're twisted, they're adapted, they're attached together. You've done quite a lot of interesting things with it. What do you try to create in the minds of the people who see it?
Yeah, I want it always to be quite fun, and I try and make components, so different objects. So when you walk into the space, it's almost like being in a gallery, and there's lots of different things to look at. So it's not like one installation, it's lots of little installations to have a look at.
Having changed the nature of the objects, obviously, and done something different with them, and then you've strategically put them in these places that essentially doesn't it change your perception of the area that you're in, especially if you already know it?
Yeah, it's quite surprising what you can learn about the space, really, from what the artwork says, sort of different things which you didn't even know were there.
What kind of led up to doing that?
I always work with the space, it's quite important, and things dictate where the work will go. So if there's something I can hang or use, I will use it rather than add to the space. I like to use what's already there, and then it helps show what's in the space.
And in your life, normally, do you like to leave your mark on things, to leave it, you know, to alter things with your character and personality and your artistic flair? Is that something you like to do?
I do like to organise things and have things in a certain way, so probably yes.
It does sort of say, you know, when you see something like that, you think somebody's been here, somebody's done something like that, and it does arouse a certain amount of curiosity. Where does that lead?
Yeah, I don't know really. I suppose there's a different like presence, like someone's been there and they're trying to show something, highlight the space a bit more.
Mm-hmm. And are those pieces outside all the pieces that you're doing, or are there other pieces?
I made them all specially for this exhibition. They're all quite site-specific in that way, but I would like to reuse them, perhaps change them a little bit and take them to a different space and see how they respond there.
Mm-hmm. And what's the dynamic like between all of the artists in this show? Because it's an interesting, varied group of things going on there.
Yeah, there's a real mix. It's nice. It's different ages, different practices, people from London, Suffolk and Norwich as well. So it's a really good dynamic,
And what's the art scene in Norwich like at the moment? Because obviously Cambridge seems to be going from strength to strength at the moment. More and more people are joining the arts and it's becoming much more integrated. Is the same thing happening in Norwich?
It's the same with Norwich, NUCA as well, which is now Norwich University of the Arts. That's got a massive impact on Norwich. It's very cultural and arts, with Norwich and Norfolk Arts Festival coming up in May. That's always a really good event.
Do you have an art space in Norwich. Are you bringing in artists from Cambridge as well over there?
Haven't done yet, but perhaps Outpost will return the favour and have Kettle Shard show or another Cambridge-based Aidan Abett maybe can come over. it's good.
Okay, now this exhibition runs right through till the end of March, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's actually on till April. I think it's the 14th of April. Mm. So there's lots of time to see the work, which will probably change, no doubt, over the time.
Mm-hmm.
What happens at home can often be the centre of your world, and it's not always a bed of roses. Being homeless is definitely far worse, but it can be food for thoughts that you might share and sometimes draw inspiration from. Coming up over the summer are a series of events which take a positive tack for people with a range of issues at home, without a home, or just want to help others in need of one. Homeless Link is running a series of free art workshops for homeless people with Streetwise Opera. Artists Hugh Chapman and Saida Khan are joining forces with Dr. Doodley's Drink and Draw at the Hot Numbers Cafe in Gwydir Street in an informal event for artists and local people to draw and make things. Artworks will then be used for the MAP project, which is an attempt to collaborate and make a large-scale community artwork. The maps can be about anything and from any perspective, real or fantasy. Askance Publishing has also launched a new international short story and arts competition to raise money for Emmaus self-help community and offers £250 in prize money. Winning entries on the subject of home will be published into an anthology and be launched at Cambridge School of Art. Diane Morrison, facilitator of Flat Magazine, which encourages writing among the homeless in Cambridge.
I gather that later on in the summer, FLAC is going to be involved in something called the MAC project with Dr. Doodley's Drink and Draw. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Because it sounds like a very interesting project.
In terms of the MAC project, we've already done one workshop and we're going to do another one. And I think it's the idea is about getting different groups around Cambridge to sort of map their experience, not just in terms of the geography of Cambridge, but just sort of, it's more of a mental geography.
So it's mind mapping and geographical mapping and everything in between.
Yeah, it's a 2D artwork sort of collage, but meant to be sort of interactive and building on things and people working together to sort of psychologically, mentally map their experience of Cambridge.
Now they're going to actually be meeting at the Hot Numbers Cafe with Dr. Doodley's Drink and Draw. Isn't there very much an emphasis on large scale artworks for that project?
I think the outcome is going to be some sort of large map, I guess.
Yeah. So who can get involved in that and who will be joining it?
I think anyone can join the Dr. Doodley's. Mm. Our group at FLAC is only the workshops, anything that we do at FLAC is generally it's open to people who are homeless or have been homeless. But I think that anyone can join Dr. Doodley. And the MAP project will also, I think they're going to be going to other charities as well, so it just depends on which services you access.
There's also the Streetwise Opera and Art project coming up, which I gather that FLAC may be involved with as well. What's that going to entail? There's various things coming up in the summer. What's FLAC agenda going to be for activities for people in the arts sector and homeless or needing housing sector in terms of activities that they can get involved in?
We'll just be keeping on doing the same thing that we always do, which is we provide membership opportunities for people who are homeless and also visitor access for people who are homeless or have been homeless. What that means is anyone who's homeless or has been homeless can write for an article for a magazine. They don't have to be a member, but they can come and visit us. We're open 7 days a week, so it's creative writing. We also do films. We've got storytelling every Sunday. We also have a dance project at the moment. There's been three workshops that are based around dance, which is run by people called Dance Moves, and what they do is try and get people moving in a very sort of open way. And gradually build up some choreographed movement around that and sort of trying to make dance much more accessible to people who don't think that they can dance. And we've done two workshops and they've been really interesting and really exciting. We're making a film to sort of make a record of what we've done. And we've got the last one coming up a week this Saturday, so that'll be the 23rd March. And we've got a few spaces for that, which, you know, if you're homeless, then, you know, you can come along, no questions asked. And members of the public, we have around 5 spaces for members of the public to get involved as well. So anyone who wants to get involved in a dancing project, that's the last one's going to be the 23rd of March. We're also always making films in FLAC, so there's always going to be a chance to get involved in making a film. We publish poetry. I said we've got storytelling that happens every Sunday. We're also making a sort of pop-up theatre, which is a vehicle that we've been given some funding to create, which means that we can go around town and sort of promote what we're doing and, you know, showcase all the pieces of work that people have done at FLAC. We've got an Easter egg hunt, which is going to be just at the end of March. There'll be a hunt around Cambridge for these magical Easter eggs, which are going to have little messages and possibly prizes inside them. And we can't think of anything else that we're doing.
It seems to me that writing for FLAC magazine can actually open up all kinds of doors to people and get them engaged with interesting things here.
Yeah.
But there's also a writing competition coming up with Askance Publishing and Emmaus Community.
Yeah.
Is that something that you encourage people who have any kind of home issue to get involved with? Because it does have, obviously, cash prizes and obviously an opportunity to communicate, you know, very well.
It looks like it's a really good opportunity because you're getting a chance of getting published, but also I'm not sure how much they're charging, but if you enter the competition and you win, you can win a cash prize. So the money that they raise from competition entries is going to go towards Emmaus, and Emmaus is brilliant, and we're really supportive of Emmaus. That we actually did an issue that was focused on them last, I think it was around July or June or July, I can't remember exactly, but one of our issues focused on Emmaus, and they're a brilliant community. They help to rehabilitate people. We're going to be promoting that competition within FLAC for people who are members or just anyone who wants to get involved in, you know, writing a short story. You know, we may end up publishing stuff that doesn't, you know, end up winning, just because if it's focused around home, then it's obviously really important to us. Our editorial policy, just for anyone who would want to write for FLAC, is that anything we consider for publication has to be written by someone who is homeless or has had some experience of homelessness. Now, the category, the definition of what homeless is we're quite broad with that category. It means you could have been sofa surfing, you could have been very vulnerably housed. So it doesn't mean you don't have to have had spent ages and ages on the street to be published. But we do ask that, you know, you're quite open about, you know, It is for people who've experienced homelessness, but people can remain anonymous if they want to do so.
Okay, so there's a lot of things happening that people can get involved with, are very positive over the summer. What has FLAC as an organisation, what have been its recent achievements? What's happened?
Well, in November, we just secured funding to keep us going for 3 years, which is really excellent, because it means we're going to keep on, we've been delivering some excellent outcomes for people, and we have, our funding application was based on the amount of people that we've helped to, you know, rebuild their life a little bit and give them a little boost of confidence so that they can apply for more jobs or get on the housing, get into social housing, or just kind of maybe secure with maybe mental health issues or any issues in their life that they need some support with. We've been there as a sort of safety net to sort of give some positivity back and give people a safe place to come to and explore their skills and work out what they want to do next. So we've secured big lottery funding for 3 years, which is really great. But it doesn't mean that we don't need to keep on looking for funding. We still need to. We still need to secure sales. Even though the sales of our magazine have been going up, and it's really brilliant. We've got lots of great vendors. But we also, you know, we need to keep on selling the magazine. Like anyone in media will know, you don't, just because you have one good month or one good week, it could drop off quite quickly. And we're quite reliant on street vendors. And, you know, it's a difficult thing to do. So I'd say our sales are rising, but we still need to keep going and, you know, stay positive. And we've just secured a couple of film commissions. Filmmaker Toby won the Digital Heroes Award, which was last year. We recently have hired a new services director, so that's another, and two support workers and listings editor. So we've managed to expand our team, which has been really brilliant, because it means we can, instead of a few people doing a few, you know, doing all doing three jobs at once, we've got more staff who can spread out and help people. What else have we done? Well, the April issue is just about ready to go. We've just about decided what's going to be in the April issue, so that'll be coming out quite soon. We've got quite a fun theme coming up around pets, and obviously the themes around April. And
is there a feeling that the arts and minds and the homelessness and arts sector is becoming much more well organised and integrated in terms of the networks involved and helping people towards their talents and projects more easily now, or is it getting harder?
I don't know. I mean, I've been with FLAC and doing this type of thing in Cambridge for about 2 years, so I don't have years and years of experience, but I think that there's definitely a sense that there's more, homelessness is rising, there's more understanding among people that homelessness can affect anyone, and so there's a bit less stigma, and there's a lot of kind of creative projects. From my sense, there is quite a lot of collaboration going on, but we can still work on that. And sometimes there can be a little bit of, I don't know, people getting into their little ghettos. They either like what people do at Jimmy's Night Shelter, or they like what people do at Winter Comfort, or they like what we do at FLAC, and they tend to just stay in one place. And what we want to do is make sure that people find the right place, the right space for them, but also don't just use one place because just out of habit. You know, they know that there's a lot more out there, so what, you know, we make a big effort to try and publicize everything that's going on other places, so that, you know, if someone's major issue is mental health rather than homelessness, then really they should be somewhere like Lifecraft. If they're not particularly interested in creative writing or journalism, then they might be better getting involved in woodwork or willow weaving or doing some voluntary work with Winter Comfort or with Jimmy's, you know, rather than being involved in FLAC. So everyone's got a place, and it's not necessarily the first place that they land at. So I'd say it's as there's more projects coming up as well, it does mean that there's probably a bit of competition for funding too. So although we are trying to work together, there's always a sense in the back of your mind that you know, who's the priority. But we try and work together with all the different agencies as much as possible. Just make sure people are going to the right place at the right time and that they know what's going on.
Dan, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
It's time to take a look at a few events worth catching in the next few weeks. St Matthew's Passion by J.S. Bach will fill King's College Chapel with Easter Glory on March the 25th and 26th. The Arts Theatre stages Molière's The Misanthrope on the 26th and 30th of March. Wising Arts features a day of talks, screenings and performances on March the 23rd to accompany Relatively Absolute, a current exhibition. Cambridge Art Salon present painter Hilwa's Toop on The People Who Shape Her World from March the 16th to 26th. The Little Angel Theatre presents Dogs Don't Do Ballet at the Junction on April the 7th, a tale about a dog called Biff who thinks he's a ballerina. The Young Actors Company presents Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island at the Mumford Theatre on the 20th and 23rd of March, and also offer the play Black Hand's Dead Section on the 21st at the Mumford, a play about protests against the Vietnam War in the 60s and the West German student revolutionaries. Punk band The Stranglers return to the Corn Exchange on Friday the 22nd with the supporting band Godfathers. Coming up at the Junction on March the 21st, Gob Squad cross the boundaries between performers and audiences and then later screen a film exploring death and reenact classic film scenes. And that brings us to the end of the show. I'm Simon Burton and I hope you enjoyed an hour of art stories on Cambridge 105.